Hold on. That was just my preface. And so the other thing that I want to say is that I often sort of approach having to speak to large people in the rooms, especially OA, where it's compulsive overeater, 100-pounder, anorexic, bulimic, spitter outer, I mean, exercise bulimic. I mean, just this array. And so it makes me think of like an art school where you go to the, this art college, right? And it's got this big umbrella called art college, but think of the diverse people that are in that college. There are sculptors and painters and dancers and poets and writers and clay makers and tapestry work. I mean, all different. So if you take all of those students and bring them into one speaking auditorium for an event, there's, you know, there's some things that the speakers say, I cannot speak to every single form of this disease because I don't have every single form of this disease. I certainly have a wide array of how this disease is manifested. So, you know, what I learned early in the rooms is take what you want, leave the rest. And I also learned to identify and don't compare. So don't worry if I tell, if I share things that don't feel that resonate with you. That doesn't necessarily mean that everything I say is useless, you know? And I, after years of being in the rooms, I always try to find where I can connect with whomever is speaking, whether it's someone sharing or sharing, whatever. I always look for where we're connecting as opposed to where we're different. So that's my sort of recommendation for you. I'm getting a little freaked out by the numbers going up, but that's okay. I know that I'm with my family. I love that I've got my Canadian family, my East Coast family, love my East Coast family, my English family. I'm all about Terry Pratchett, so go England. You know, I mean, it's just, I'm just going to take a moment here not to like just implode on myself. So because when I go to speak to workshops and everything, you know, when I go face to face, it's like 50 people, you know what I mean? And they're certainly not from all over the planet, you know? So this is, you know, this is the benefit of Zoom and the downside of Zoom. So the other thing that I want to give a little bit, I am going to go into my story. I'm going to try to kind of, let me, because I want to do this, like, first, I'm just telling my stories. I'm just letting you guys know, who am I? You know, why, you know, how am I, what tribe am I from? You know, how am I, like, just who's my story? Why should you even listen to me? And then I really want to go into the experience I had around shame getting in the way of my recovery and my, the experience that I had around healing that. And then at the end, I want to save time for definitely for shares and for Q&A. Typically, I do Q&A first so people can kind of get any sort of maybe intellectual, you know, questions out of the way. And then we can go into open sharing of more, you know, sharing our hearts or whatever. So I really recommend that you have a piece of pen and paper. Oftentimes, I will answer your question by the time we get to Q&A, but sometimes I don't. So anyway, I want to give myself, you know, a little bit of time here. But so OA was not my first program. My recovery date is October 27th, 1993. And I came into ACOA first, went into some other programs. I think OA was like my fourth program. I'm not quite sure, but I think it was. And by that time, my friend 12-stepped me in. And how she 12-stepped me in was that I was in DA, learning how to, you know, create a budget and balance a checkbook. And we were looking at my budget, and she noticed that I wasn't spending any money on clothes. And I thought that that was something positive, like, okay, here's something I'm not spending any money on. Look at me save money, which is now we know a form of restricting. And she kept asking me questions and why I wasn't. And I was like, oh, I hate shopping. Why do you hate shopping? Well, I hate buying clothes. You know, why do you hate buying clothes? I hate looking at myself in the mirror. I hate trying on clothes, whatever. And then she said, there's this program, you know, I'd like you to go to. And at that point I just said, yes, I had no idea where she was taking me. It was kind of like, sure, whatever. So my first OA meeting was the only 12-step meeting where I was blown away. I had no idea, none. This is 1998. I had no idea that other women felt this way because it was all women in the meeting. At that particular meeting, that they felt this way, that other women had feelings about food the way that I had feelings about food, and specifically that they had feelings about their body the way that I had feelings about my body. And I cried in that first meeting. And I need you to know that I'm not a crier, and I've actually had to spend a lot of money on therapy so that I could cry. So the fact that I was crying, you know, was like, and I had two feelings simultaneously. On the one hand, I had this feeling of like this incredible, like, wow, like, I can't believe these people, you know, they speak my language, they're whatever. And at the other feeling I had was like busted, like I am busted, and this terror that they were going to take my food away, you know? And I felt like, and I've told this story so many times, but I felt like Linus with the blankie. Like, for those of us who are familiar with the Peanuts characters, you know, there's Linus walking around with his blankie. Well, he's in first grade walking around with his blankie, and, you know, they just let him do that. Well, imagine Linus at 29, you know what I mean? Or 28, you know, and he's got his blankie. You know, at some point people are going to be like, hey, let's talk about that blankie you're carrying around. And so if you could just imagine like Linus being like, no, you know, and the reason why I like that particular character is because Linus is also the one that spouts this like spiritual wisdom for people who don't know the strip. So Linus is the one that's like the voice of God, you know, in all these little scenarios, and yet he's walking around with a blankie. And that's what it was like for me. I was the sort of designated driver in my family. I was the friend that everyone called, you know what I mean, for advice or to run things by. I was the reliable one. I was the responsible one, and yet I had my food. So a brief description is that, let's see, in doing my food history, and so people who are new to the program, one of the things that's really helpful is to do a food history where you do like this timeline and you look at your patterns. One thing that I recommend is that when I take what I did for myself and what I then did for my sponsees is when it came to the food history, you know, I noticed there were gaps in between, like, oh, this time in my life, I was really focused on candy bars. So like when I was really little and stealing money to get candy bars and stealing food, like writing out like all of the little behaviors and doing that whole, like, get a whole box of chocolate bars to sell, you know, to people so that you could raise some money for your school. And meanwhile, I've eaten half the chocolate bars and my mom has to, you know, supplement the money. And, you know, so even the, and knowing that I was going to get in trouble and not caring, like not caring that I was going to get in trouble as long as I had. So again, that immediate gratification. And then also like stealing money from my parents' change jar to go and get, you know, candy and doing stuff like that. And then sort of, you know, I would notice that I would go like this and then I would be like, yeah, so that was when I was younger. And then when I was in like a 11, 12 puberty, it was, oh, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And that's when I gained my weight. So I was a normal looking kid, you know, I was hyperactive, loved candy. And I also loved fat. So I would eat raw butter, you know, I would just take, you know, butter out of bites of butter, not too much, otherwise it was gross, but I would just, you know, eat raw butter, and do little things like that. And then I noticed that like when I was 11 to 12 is when, I started, you know, puberty hit, all the rules were changing. I went from being a tomboy playing with the boys to all of a sudden being cast as a girl and being treated in a sexual way. And I was like, I am so not ready for this. And so then I gained all this weight as a way to desexualize my body. Well, here's the thing that I like to tell people when they do a food history is like, oh, okay, that's interesting. So when I'm younger, you know, 6, 7, 8, I see like all of this, candy behavior. And then there's like a gap. And then I see, you know, junior high, like peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and eating whatever. And I learned to ask myself, well, what happened? What was I doing in that gap year, you know, in that period of time? And instead of thinking like, oh, I turned into a normal person for those 5 years and then went back to some, I'm like, no. And that's in doing my, so when I do my food history, I actually kind of frame it as what was my escape history. And that's when I notice in the gap between, you know, being this 5, 6, 7, 8, you know what I mean? You know, eating, being fascinated with candy. And then this other time period, it's like, oh, that's when I was left home alone all the time. And I watched TV from the time I walked in the door until the time I went to bed. And that's like, oh, that then was my escape mechanism, was just like, basically, what were the obsessive behaviors that I was doing where I was trying to escape living in my own life? So, so that's kind of, and then, so at junior high, I gained 60 pounds and I took, I'm 5'7", and I took myself up to about 185 pounds. My top weight is about 200, 205. I stopped weighing at that point. I was in 1X is kind of my top weight. And then my normal weight is a size 10. And then when I was underweight, it was a size 8. I'm 50 and my metabolism is slowed. And so I'm a size 12. And I'm happy with it. I'm just like, I'm not willing to do what it takes. Basically, I would have to live a sort of anorectic lifestyle in order for me to maintain my 30-year-old body. And I'm not willing to do that. And I don't think I should have to. So I'm just throwing out some numbers there for you so you know who you're talking to. But anyway, so one of the reasons why I gained weight is that I'm an adult child of two alcoholic parents. And when I was younger and they were a young couple, there was a lot of punching of walls. My dad had a temper and he punched walls. And so this display of this violent anger, as they got older and my dad started to make more money and we lived in a middle-class neighborhood and were middle-class, that physical anger converted into this underlying simmering verbal abusive behavior, this sort of cutting down and cutting down. But my dad did charge at me one time, and my dad weighed 185 pounds. He was 5'11", weighed 185. And so somewhere in the, this is, I understand all this, by the way, through doing 12-step and uncovering my history, is that I thought, oh, that's why I gained at 185, and 185 became like this weight that I needed to be. Because number one, it desexualized my body. And number two, it gave me the sense that if any man came at me in a physical way, I was physically able to, at least on a weight-wise, match them. And so that really hit me psychologically. So then, so that's some of the trauma that I've had to deal with and growing up with that. And growing up basically with, you know, the form of abuse that I've had to deal with the most in terms of being an adult child of two alcoholic parents is just neglect, just completely being forgotten about and left on my own and not taken back to. I mean, it was just crazy. So I come into the rooms at around 185. I had done crazy things. Because my story is really long and I want to get into coming into the rooms, working the program, getting the promises of the program, having a major relapse, coming out of it's a long story, so I don't want to kind of go too much into the details. I just want to show you, like, here's the family background that I came from. Here's sort of my eating habits. I came up to about 185. And then the other thing that I learned, again, through the process of recovery is, well, how was I able to maintain 185? Why didn't I keep just going up and going up? Well, that's where I learned that even at 185, I was doing bulimic behaviors. And my bulimic behaviors at that point were binging and then under eating. binging and then over-exercising. So I was already in, you know, at 185, I was in a bulimic, and I was an exercise bulimic, and I was an under-eating bulimic. There are four types of bulimia that's kind of common. One is the laxatives. You binge, and then you so bulimia is you binge, you freak out, and then you do something to correct the binge. And so that can be laxatives, purging, exercising, or restricting. So I was a restricting exercise bulimic, and that's how I made 185. So I came into the rooms at 185. I got a sponsor. I thought it was all about the food. I thought it was about dieting. I did all of that. But she just kept telling me it's not about the food. And I just kept coming back. And my process was really slow. And I want you to know, like, I'm an alpha female, type A, overachiever. I came in, I liked it, everything everyone told me to do. And the weight still took forever to come off. I was like, basically, I lost 10 pounds every 2 years. And I would start to lose the weight, and then I'd be like, oh, it's happening. And I would try to, and then it's like, all of a sudden I took my will back, and I put myself unconsciously back on a diet. Like, okay, we're going to keep this thing going. And then I wouldn't lose any weight, because again, I have this piece of me that resents being told I need to lose weight. So it just had to be this constant surrender, surrender, surrender. It's not about the weight. Can you just keep going to the room? You're being abstinent, you're being whatever. And quite honestly, you know, from being 1X to going to an 18 to going to a 16, I remember when I was a 16 and I could actually sort of wear somewhat normal clothes. I was like, okay, if you stayed this size for the rest of your life, could you be happy? And I had to get to a place where I was like, okay, fine. And that took a long time to get there, but I had to get to that place. And it's almost like as soon as I got to that place, then I drop another 10 pounds. But you can't fake surrender. You know what I mean? You can't, okay, I've surrendered, you know, it's like, no, you have to really surrender and really be like, okay, I completely accept myself exactly as I am today. And then it's like, oh, well, now that you fully accept and love me exactly as I am, now I'm willing to sort of like lose some weight here because I'm already being loved and accepted by you. And so I don't feel that I have to lose the weight in order to be loved and accepted by myself. So that was my process. So then what happened for my story is, I lost the weight, and my story is that I lost the weight, and in losing the weight, some sexual abuse memories surfaced. So when I had 13 years, 6 years in OA, incest memories started to surface, and I already had some sexual abuse memories. I didn't need any more. And it was an extended family member, and it was devastating. It was absolutely devastating. And so that was my first major relapse. And I was so angry at the program because I had done all this work. I had gotten all this recovery. I was, like I said, 13 years. And I was, my life had gotten so much better. I was 34 and I was like, okay, you know, where now I'm going to start my amazing life. And then these trauma memories come up. And the result of those trauma memories is that I basically had an emotional breakdown and I had a physical collapse. Turns out that, you know, at, you know, 36, they started surfacing at 34 and then at 36, you know, I started getting signs and symptoms of something coming up and whatever. And it was a 2-year process with the therapist. And then at 36, the memories really surfaced. And my response to that was my body completely collapsed from adrenal exhaustion, you know, living with PTSD for 34 years at that point. And then also just the emotional piece. And so I lasted about a month. And then I relapsed. It's hard to stay abstinence if you lose complete faith in your higher power. And the higher power that I had developed at that point was basically what I understand now today was a Santa Claus higher power. That I'm like, oh, I believe in a higher power that if I do all these things, then this is what I will get. So it's like, I'm going to be the best little girl in the world. I'm going to work the hardest. I'm going to do everything, whatever. And then, you know, my higher power is going to give me, you know, the life, the house, the relationship, the whatever. And the problem is that what I was actually praying for was I was praying for the truth. I knew this like thing around like the truth sets me free. And so I kept praying for the truth, you know, please help me know what's true. The principle of step one is honesty. And I was just like, you know, knowledge, you know thyself, the truth sets us free, blah, blah, blah. And so I kept praying, you know, to the God of my understanding. And I use God as a placeholder in this. You know, I believe in something mysterious and beautiful, and that's as far as I define it. But in the rooms, it's just really easy to say God. If you have a problem with that word, you can think of, you know, I always like group of dames or good orderly direction or good omniscient direction. There's just whatever. So if I use that word, I consider myself to be a pagan Buddhist, New Thought Christian Jew, part-time Hindu Muslim. So I'm just like, if I hear, when I hear divine truth, it doesn't matter where I am. I'm like, I can hear it, whether it's a Quaker meeting or, you know, a Native American circle. I'm like, oh, okay, divine truth is here. And that's kind of my higher power. But anyway, I had been praying to my higher power that the truth would set me free principle. So you can imagine that I got exactly what I was praying for, but it was so not what I wanted. And my response to that was I felt extremely betrayed. I felt extremely set up, and especially because I was in the rooms with people who had less time than me, and they were getting the boyfriend and getting the amazing job. I had the amazing job. I had the amazing apartment, but you know, they were like, and I was like, it's literally as if you're in line for Santa Claus to hand out gifts, and you see like all the girls in front of you or all the kids in front of you, boy or girl, whatever, getting these toys. And it's my turn. And God's like, and here are some incest memories for you. And, you know, that's what it felt like for me. So that's why I lost my relationship with a higher power. And I lasted a month. And then I was so devastated and whatever that I decided to take sugar back. I'm a sugar addict. Early in the rooms, just so you know, people were not validating sugar addiction. And it was really difficult because so many people in the rooms were eating sugar. And so that's a part of my story. But anyway, so I lasted about a month, and then I went to the corner and the coffee house that had, you know, muffin or whatever, because my favorite combination is white flour, fat, sugar. Like that's my favorite combination, whether it's biscuits and gravy or cupcakes or whatever. It's like, yeah, that's me. So, and then what happened is that for those who don't know, your disease progresses even when you're abstinent. So I like, once I binged, now, because I had lost all the weight, you guys. So now I was freaked out about getting fat again. So now I have that fat phobia. And I purge, and I had tried purging before, and it was like, it didn't really work. I guess I just didn't have my heart in it. But this time I had my heart in it. And then I started to understand the purging and the addiction of purging and that feeling and that high of getting it out. And then after you throw up, your body thinks you're sick when you throw up. So then it floods you with endorphins. So I have this physical experience of throwing up all my feelings, you know, and then afterwards I feel a little better, but it's a lie because I haven't gotten rid of my feelings. You know, I've just given myself an endorphin rush, through this sort of symbolic act of purging. So, and that started to get really bad. And that was my first major relapse. And how I came out of that was, I actually went to, I knew a woman from another program who was in AA, And like I said, this was in the Bay Area. I'm from the Bay. I live up in Portland now, but I'm from San Francisco Bay Area. And in the Bay Area, you know, there was a lot of eating of sugar. And the danger with that was I kept telling myself I could be that person. And so I needed someone who had a really strong, you know, yes, no program. And so I found a woman, Kimberly, and I just said, who was in AA. And I said, look, I'm in OA. I have a sugar addiction problem. I need to be, you know, go through the steps like hardcore. Will you sponsor me? She said, I have to ask my sponsor. She asked her sponsor, a woman I've never met. And I wish I could find that woman and say, you saved my life that day, because Kimberly's sponsor told her, if you, because they both were like, I've never heard this before, but the sponsor told Kimberly, if you can help that woman, then you help her. And so I met with, and Kimberly was like, and this is how I sponsor today. Kimberly was like, okay, Sundays at 10 a.m., we're going to do this. We're going to go through the big book. Here's step one. Here's your reading assignment. Here are your step work assignments every week. And we had assignments for every step, and we have went through. And through that process, I was able to get abstinent again. Meanwhile, I'm still sick. I'm still dealing with the trauma memories. I'm dealing with the emotional effects of that. And my personality changed. My physical abilities changed. My personality changed in that I was very, you know, extroverted. And with the trauma memories, one of the things that I experienced was just being so overwhelmed with sound and noise and whatever that all I developed of agoraphobia. And for people who don't know what agoraphobia is, it's not the fear of going outside. Agoraphobia is the fear that I'm going to be somewhere and I'm going to get triggered and I'm going to have a panic attack. And then I'm going to be with people who will socially ridicule me, or I won't be able to get to a safe space. So that's what agoraphobia is. It's about like, oh, I can't go there because what if I get triggered and have a panic attack? You know what I mean? So, and for people who are silently suffering from this, let me tell you that how you do that is you get yourself an ally, and you can Google that and everything. So you always make sure you have a safe person with you who understands that you may get triggered, and then you can go wherever you want and you start to learn that you're safe again. Anyway, that was your public service announcement for agoraphobics. So Kimberly, she takes me through the steps. I move up to Portland because it was a quieter environment than San Francisco. I was in San Francisco proper. And again, with exhaustion issues and having health issues, I needed to be in a calmer environment. And my best friend was up here. So I moved up here, and then I started rebuilding my community, rebuilding my abstinence, getting recovery, and, you know, joined OA up here. And then what happened was, is that now I'm like, I'm up here, I've got a job, I've got the mentor, I've got, you know, I'm living in a very cute studio inside of a house, even though it's not ideal, it's still adorable, in a really cute neighborhood, you know, everything's starting to happen. And then what happened is that, you know, so it's sort of like the I have arrived. You know, I've arrived and this is great. And then what happened is that there was a guy at work who worked in a completely different department that I had a little bit of a crush on. And that day, and I was looking good. I was feeling hot and feeling sexy and whatever. And I was just walking around, just feeling not. And I had been sharing, like I had to check in every day with my sponsor, like, oh, I'm feeling good. I'm feeling great. You know, I've got amazing friends. I got this, whatever. And then, that day that I was feeling great and feeling good, Scott, he kind of flirted back with me. And I have to tell you that I had a total moment of terror. And I just, you know, sort of, but I was, on the one hand, I was like, awesome. But on the other hand, I really sort of froze up. And so I, you know, but I didn't think anything of it. I just got that little like fear thing in your stomach. You know, people call it butterflies or whatever, but I was like, oh my gosh. And then that was a Thursday. And by Friday, I had intentionally broken my abstinence. And there's a whole story around that. And when I called my sponsor to tell her, her response to me when we finally met was that when she heard my check-in and she heard me say, because Thursday she hears me say like how amazing, like it was basically like this week of my life, you know, I'm grateful for this. It's amazing. It's amazing. It's amazing. It's amazing. And then Friday she hears me say, I broke my abstinence. And at that point I had like 5 years or something. And her intuitive thought was, wow, she's not going to let herself have this. And she told me that. And that really hit me. And it hit me in the sense of, and this is where, like, my story is my opinion, but it hit me in the sense of, I have been in 12 step at that point, like 20 years. And I had experienced amazing recovery. And here it was handed to me. And it's like someone taking this gift and putting it towards me, and I smash it down. And I realize, like, that's me. And so the other thing that happened, and this is how God works in my life, is that I went to a AA women's conference on Friday to see my friend. I was only planning to go on Friday night because she was the local speaker. I go, I come home, I was house sitting that weekend, and here's how I broke my abstinence. I took a bite of jam. First of all, I was looking around in this kitchen that wasn't mine for food that wasn't mine. I'm like, whatever. And then I found, and unfortunately, my friend is so friggin' woo-woo and makes a foodie and everything. There's all these basic ingredients. I mean, there was nothing like made. It was like she cooks. I was like, ugh. And so I found this jam, you know, that she, because she preserves her own, you know, fruit, and she makes jam. And I found this jam. And now I'm a sugar addict, right? And I'm going to test the jam. So I test the jam, and it's like, sure enough, it has sugar on it. Now that's fair. It's like, okay, I give a little test. I'm like, it's got sugar in it. This is when I'm in my right mind, I put the lid on it, I put it back, and I do a prayer or make a reach out call. That's not what I did. I took it, and I took a big, huge bite, and I took another bite, and I took two bites of jam. Now here's the thing. People are like, you took two bites of jam? That doesn't include the little tester bite. You know what I mean? Yes, because those two bites did exactly what I wanted it to do. They broke my abstinence and they woke the beast. And that was the part that terrified me, was that all of a sudden the beast was awake and I knew it. And all of a sudden my brain was like, we just lost our abstinence. We're going to have to get abstinent again. So we are in no man's land, which means if there's anything you want to eat, now's the time to go do it. Well, I also had enough experience to know it is so much harder to get abstinent than to stay abstinent. And I had enough recovery to know that I was talking crazy to myself and I was really scared. It was literally like I was like on, you know, on this cliff edge and I was losing my balance. And even though like my disease was trying to tell me like that I was going to fall into a vat of ice cream, my recovery was like, no, there are sharp rocks down there. And I was like, okay, I need to get myself over here. And so what I did was, is I immediately called my sponsor, told the truth. And then I planned the morning to go back to that AA conference. And what I did was, I want to just give myself like maybe 3 more minutes. What I did was, is that I went there and I stayed there. I wouldn't leave the conference because I was so afraid of where I was going to go. And so I stayed there all day Saturday in this horrible state, by the way, because I was just really genuinely afraid, because I know that the disease progresses and my bulimia had really progressed that time that I relapsed the first time. And I was purging. I went from purging a little bit to purging once a day, to purging like a couple times a day. I was like, this is horrible. And that's when I met Kimberly and managed to get, you know, and I did have to do some harm reduction behavior. That's a whole nother talk, but I managed to get abstinent. So I was genuinely terrified for myself. But here's the thing that happened. So I'm there for my friend Nadja Friday night. I have a place to go on Saturday where I'm like, surrounded 24/7 the whole time. And then I, you know, I'm the last one to leave. I come home, I'm the first one in the morning. And Sunday morning there was a speaker and I really identified with her. And she talked about shame. She talked about sexual trauma. She talked about, you know, sexuality, feeling vulnerable in a female body, and she talked about shame. And I went up to her and I asked her to be my sponsor. Now, she was my sponsor for about a month because it just wasn't a good fit, even though we were really, I sort of recognized that she had a lot less recovery in these other areas that made me, but her first assignment was, and I can't tell you guys this, but she had me read a book. And if you want a book, if you want the name of the book, I've got two books. And if you want the name, you're going to have to text me because there's a weird line. So let me take a moment to explain this. So there's AA conference approved literature and there's OA conference approved literature. And so almost all of the AA conference approved literature is OA conference approved literature. And you can talk about that. However, in AA, there are these unofficial AA books that are written by members of Alcoholics Anonymous that are not conference approved. And I read two of them by members of Alcoholics Anonymous that are very popular, that are about shame, but they're not conference approved. So I can't tell you the names about them. But what I can tell you is that I'm going to give everyone my contact information and all you have to do is email me. But I need people to know that I can't promote these books because they're not official. But that's what happened. She told me, you know what I mean, in her ultimate wisdom and whatever, same thing with my sponsees, she told me to read this book. And that started my shame study. So I read that book. I read a Hazelton pamphlet. And then I read another book about women in shame. And then I did a shame inventory for myself. And then I took friends through, that's good, that's kind of perfect. Then I took friends through, I took a couple of friends through a shame study to see, like, can I pass this on, right? I did this for myself, and then can I pass this on? And it worked. And then I started another shame group, you know what I mean? And then it worked for them. And then I started another one. And then I started, like, someone said, you know, in Seattle, do you want to come up? What do you want to talk about? I'm like, I want to talk about shame. You know what I mean? Because my story is that for whatever reason, and this again is an opinion, 12-step saved my life. And it took me as far as it could take me. And I was in my own way. I kept getting in my own way of recovery. Now, I know some people think, like, well, if you're in the rooms, that will heal the shame. And it does. It does. But sometimes some of us maybe are a little sicker than others. And we need to address shame way more focused and directly. Now, for me, the solution is still the same. One addict talking to another. You know what I mean? It's not me going to a school and studying shame, you know, from some professional. It's me doing a shame study with the women and men in the rooms. And we go through this together. And then the magic happens. Like, we start talking about these real important shame feelings that we have. And then we get the identification piece. We get the empathy piece. And then that shame starts to heal. Just like in the rooms where you're talking about food and whatever. So the solution is the same. It's literally just as if there's a little special topic study, you know, happening. So that's kind of my story. I want to take a little bit of a 5-minute break. So now you know who I am and why, you know, we're doing this. I'm going to then go into a little bit more focus. I'm just going to take 5 minutes so that I can get some water, go to the bathroom. I'm going to go into a little bit more focused of exactly what that shame inventory was. And then I want to take us through the shame inventory piece. And also I want to leave time for questions and answers. So, okay. Yeah. Melinda, you got it?
I got it. Thank you so much, Nicole. That was awesome. So we'll take a 5-minute break. I'm going to turn the chat function back on. So if anyone wants to share their numbers or ask for outreach, or we have a great group of people with us right now, if anyone wants to identify as sponsors, or if anyone is looking for a sponsor, this is a great opportunity to do that. And also just, you know, run to the restroom and get some water. You need to. We're going to be here for a little bit longer, so feel free to do so. I'll put my information in the chat as well. Oh, yes. Thank you, Elise. We are still recording right now. I believe we're going to record into the shame workshop, but then when we get to the Q&A, we'll stop recording.
Melinda, I'll turn the recording off, or I'll pause it. I'm back. I haven't had a chance to read the notes. I will after. I think I heard Melinda say that she's going to share my contact. Also, it's my phone number is with my name. I assume you guys can see that. If not, it's 503-442-2777. It's near impossible to get me on the phone because I'm of service to so many people, but I do respond to text and emails. My email address is N as in Nicole, L as in Lynn, my last name Sharkey, Sharkey at gmail.com. And again, I'll post this. Also, I have which I'm going to do right now. I have a recovery drive, which I will share with you. That has, I just saw it. Sorry, I have. So, where you can find. So all the stuff that I've done over the years, I have accumulated a G drive, which I make public. And so I will put this in the chat. I very much encourage you to access it and go through it and see what I have in there. And the URL, the URL is tinyurl, so tinyurl.com/NLS, as in Nicole Lynn Sharkey, 12 step. So, and that's my, I can share my screen. So let me share my screen. So I'll share here. So this is, can you guys see this? So this comes from my my drive. And you see retreat material. And here's audio files of speakers that I like, including some of my recordings. I did a big book study. Here's my 4-step worksheet. And then if you scroll down, there's just all stuff that I use. And there is the shame inventory instructions right there. So I just, again, I have the first 3 chapters of a book that I strongly recommend, but I can't refer to. Here is the Hazelton booklet. And there's just, it's just me over the years having sort of gathered a bunch of stuff. And then I just, like I said, I made it public. I'm going to get, as long as I'm sharing my screen, let me see if where I had that right here. So here's the shame. So what I would recommend you guys do, you don't have to, but there are 12 categories. So while I'm talking, I'm going to keep this up so that you guys can, and if you're on the phone, you know, first of all, you'll be able to pick it up just by listening. The first category is appearance and body image. The second category is money and work. The third is motherhood and fatherhood or slash fatherhood. Four is family. Five is parenting. Six is mental and physical health. Seven is addiction. Eight is sex. Nine is aging. 10 is religion. 11 is surviving trauma. And 12 is being stereotyped or labeled. But again, these are on my on the drive. So I'm just going to leave this up on the screen. Again, if you're on the phone, you can, if you write down tinyurl.com/NLS12step, it will take you to the drive that everyone's looking at, and you can scroll down and find the PDF called Shame Inventory Instructions. But so this is the portion of the reason why I wanted to tell my story first is one is so that I can just, you know, let you guys know who I am, what's motivating me to do this. And then this is the sort of the workshop piece. And this is where I'm going to get a little academic because that's my personality. You know what I mean? It's I'm not an expert on this. Again, I'm a Capricorn. And I was, you know, a nerd and a student, and I'm an armchair professor. So it's just how, and for my own recovery, I love to research things. And so then I research, you know, let's see, let me move that up a little bit. I research all the stuff because I believe that, you know, the principle of honesty is what is true, and the truth sets me free. And so the more I learn about truth, the truth as in who I am as a person, truth as in to what aspects about my disease, the truer I am with that, then the more that I feel that I'm open to healing because I'm in a foundation of what's true and what's honest. So it's like in the beginning when I came into recovery, I had a very limited knowledge of what was true. I was in a lot of denial or a lot of confusion, or I had a lot of false ideas about myself. And I just want to make sure I think I'm recording. I hope I am. And so my foundation was pretty small. I also didn't trust people. I thought everyone was out to get me. There were all these ideas that I had that weren't valid. So what I was standing on was a very small platform. And through the process of recovery and understanding the concept of honesty, what is true, that foundation has gotten broader and broader and broader. So I'm going to throw out a couple ideas. Now, I know everyone didn't get everything here, but I am going to stop sharing this. So just trust that, you know, trust that you will have access to it. But anyway, so where there is addiction, there is shame. So if you're going to write something, where there is addiction, there is shame. So write that down. A very simple definition of shame is less than. Two words. Less than. So I'm going to work with those two concepts. Where there is addiction, there is shame. And then shame is a simple definition of shame is less than. And I love analogies. It's how I understand concepts. So I'm going to give you one. Melinda, can you do me a favor and give me at 3 o'clock? I want to make sure we have a half hour for people to share. So can like at 2:55, can you just sort of give me a 5-minute? So the concept of less than. So here's a concept that really helped me, which was thinking about a store with products in the store. And I mean, not like a supermarket or anything like that, but a little boutique. You know, in Portland, we have, I'm sure every city has a couple of streets where you go, where you see all the wonderful little shopping boutiques, not the shopping malls, but the little shopping boutiques, you know? And So we have one, and you know, typical array is they have a front window, then they have the store, and then they have the back shelf. And what do we have in the front window? What we have in the front window are their best items that are there to sort of display how amazing their store is, that sort of lures you in to their store. And then they put their best products in the window, like, you know, not the ones with the little defects on them, whatever, they put the best. And then in the store, you look for those products and there are other things. And then in the back is, you know, the shelf where things have been dinged or marked up or they haven't sold because no one wants them. And so those are all the ones that are at reduced value. They're not considered to be the same value as the ones in the store. So another way of looking at that is that in the middle of the store are all the normies who are just normal people. And then there are people in the back who are discarded, have trauma, whatever, have something. And they feel that they are worth less than the people certainly in the front of the window and the people in the regular store. Do you get what I'm saying? So that's kind of an analogy of like, oh, now here's something kind of interesting, which is that I came from a family of arrogance. My dad's dad was a colonel in the Air Force. And if you don't know the military culture, what I just told you is that my dad was a son of a duke. And so I was raised that, you know, with a very elitist mindset. And so I was raised that we were people who belonged in the front window. So, and in the United States, we have a very elitist culture, very sort of like who belongs in the front. That's why we're so fascinated with celebrity culture. It's like, oh, those people who got to the front window, you know what I mean? And we're obsessed with that perfectionism. So that was, you know, how I was raised. Well, arrogance is actually shame, because here's the thing. You've got these in the middle are just human beings being human, like where we have strong character assets. We have strong character defenses. You know, we're just human beings. We're like a mix. That's the people in the middle. Well, if you can't handle being in the middle because you feel less than, you have two kind of typical choices. You're either going to puff yourself up and make yourself believe that you're over here that you're better than, because again, you can't just be one among many, because when you're one among many, you feel like you don't belong, like you somehow are less than these people that you're talking to. And so you either puff yourself up to think that you're better than, you know, as a way to protect yourself. And that's a defense from feeling shame, is to make yourself feel like you're better than other people. Or you totally internalize that belief, and then you sort of turn into, you know, feeling like that you're the worst person in the world, you know, and that you're, you know, whatever. So that, again, it's just basically both of them. The perfectionism is a response to shame, and the sort of, you know, lack of self-care, lack of, you know, that's also, it's all shame. You know, the goal is to just be right-sized in the middle. So that's analogy I want to give you on how, you know, shame sort of functions. And then let's talk a little bit about, so that's the shame is less than. So we talked about that. And now where there is addiction, there is shame. Well, addiction is shame plus an obsessive compulsive disorder. So, and something called emotional regulation. So let me explain emotional regulation a little bit. Emotional regulation is, that's the new buzzword, is emotionally regulate. Oh, she needs to emotionally regulate. Here's healthy emotional regulation. I'm going along with my day, whatever. Something happens, whatever it is, you know, I get a call from, you know, the IRS that says that, you know, they have no record of my tax filings from 2 years ago. And not only do I owe that tax, but I own a penalty and da da da. And it's like, I have this emotional reaction. healthy emotional regulation is, I am now in a state of panic and fear, right? Healthy is, I need to call someone. I need to talk about it, you know? So I call someone and I look, basically, I'm looking for connection. I'm looking for someone who will witness the experience that I'm having right now. And that requires me reaching out, and it requires exposing the truth of myself, and it requires me finding someone who's safe, who can listen without fixing me or rescuing me or whatever. And then I share with them, and they can kind of talk me down or talk me whatever or reassure me or whatever. And then my emotions come back to center. You know what I mean? And I'm like, okay. You know what I mean? And I start to I start to ground. I start to get into my body. And so that is healthy emotional regulation, is that, you know, as human beings, we're social creatures and we have evolved, and all of our mechanisms have evolved that we depend on each other. We depend on each other for food and sustenance and survival. And we also depend on each other for emotionally regulating. Now, I was raised in, that's a normal process, and that's where recovery can take you. If you work this program, I can attest to recovery will take you to that place. However, I was raised in an environment where that was actually not a safe thing to do. It was not safe for me to have feelings and then share them. So either they weren't listened to, or they were manipulated, or I was told I was too sensitive. I was told that, especially being in an alcoholic home, I was told that, you know, what I was seeing wasn't true. I was told, you know, all kinds of crazy things. So I quickly learned that I could not go to a person when I was upset. So I have all these feelings and I need to regulate. So addiction is substituting people for a thing. I'm wired to get upset, reach for people, but because of the environment that I'm in, I don't feel safe reaching for people. It's just not an option for me. Typically, also, I'm raised by people who also, just learned that that wasn't an option for them. So they're passing this, like, look, when you're upset, reach for something, work 80 hours, go exercise for 3 hours, you know, eat something, rescue your friend from her business so that you don't have to think about your business. You know what I mean? All these different things, watch 6 hours of TV. You know what I mean? So basically that's what addiction is. Now, the first time I do it, you know, I'm like having these emotions. I need to, you know, do something with my emotions to feel better. So let's focus on the food. I reach for the food, which of course has this primal, you know, experience of nurturing and whatever. I reach for the food. I feel better, you know, and now I've got a great idea of what to do when I'm upset. Laurel, you need to stop unmuting yourself, sweetie. So now I know what to do when I'm upset. So now I have an idea. And then what happens is I get upset again. And now my brain goes, we know what to do when you have a feeling. Now I start to develop an obsessive behavior, an obsessive thought that won't get satisfied until I act it out. So obsessive, compulsive behavior. Now, I want to tie these things in. So there I am. I'm having a feeling. I'm going to get connection. The connection isn't there. And in my mind, somehow I'm thinking, I'm not worth connecting. Do you see what I'm saying? So then the story starts developing that I am less than. Like, why am I not worthy of your compassion, your time, your connection, your parenting, your patience? You know, why am I not worthy of that? So I start to think that I'm less than, I'm not worth being treated well. And so that's where it's like, okay, those feelings. So now something happens, I get upset, I don't reach for something. I don't reach for a person. I reach for a thing. You know, now anytime I have a feeling, that idea kicks in, the obsession kicks in, and now it's the compulsive behavior. And just for people who don't know, addiction lies in the reptilian part of the brain where it's just instinct. It's just like, that's why it really does take a higher power. Like addiction is so primal. It's literally, I'm hungry, eat. You know, I'm suffocating, take a breath. Like you just can't, and that's the obsessive compulsive idea. So that's the idea of like, where there is addiction, there is shame. Because somewhere along the line, I started to believe that I wasn't worthy of safe connection. And here, I just want to do a shortcut for people that when you come into the rooms, this is what you learn how to do. You learn how to substitute food for people. You learn how to pick up the phone and call when you want to eat instead of picking up the food. And you're basically taking yourself back to your own natural state of, I'm having a feeling and now I need to reach out and talk to someone and emotionally regulate through connection. And then the need to compulsively eat will be taken away. And that's been my case. It's been a very rough road, but I know that when the food is on my back, it means that I need to connect more, connect more, connect more. So now let's get to the workshop portion of, so let's go ahead and do one. So the chat, is the chat open?
Yes, the chat's open.
Okay, so for people who want to participate, we are going to take, let me do this again. Let me do a quick screen sharing. Okay, so I'm going to share my screen. There it is right there. So now what I need to know through my healing is telling me that I have shame is not helpful for me. Do you see what I mean? It's like, what does that mean? What does that look like? It's the same thing when you do an inventory. If you tell a newcomer, well, you eat because you're full of fear and resentment, it's like, okay, but what does that mean? And my fear and resentment doesn't look like Melinda's, doesn't look like Diane's. Like, I need to understand what my fear and resentment looks like. That's why we do a four step. And then the harms done and the sexual inventory is typically also like, where do I feel shame? What are the things that I just like don't want anyone to know about myself? So that process is very healing. What I found with the shame inventory is I really needed to know how I've been shamed, in what particular way. What internal beliefs have I inherited that make me feel that I am less than? And what are the things that propel me to want to keep striving for the things that I think will alleviate my shame that will in fact not alleviate my shame? So for example, I keep wanting the perfect body, thinking that if I get that perfect body, that will alleviate my shame. And then I'd be cured from feeling shamed. And of course, we know that doesn't work. I have sponsored professional models when I was in San Francisco. And I can tell you that getting a perfect body or having a perfect body in no way eradicates shame. So that was a big, huge lesson for me. So let's take the first one. We're just going to go through one together. You know what I mean? And so what you do is you take each category. And you work these next questions, which is write four or five. So you take a category, appearance and body image. And you answer, you know, what are the ideal identities that you want to have or that you want to be perceived as when it comes to appearance and body image? You write like four or five of those. Then you write four or five identities that you do not want to be perceived as. And you write four or five of those. And then there's a second part. But before we get into the second part, I want to tell you that if there's a category that you don't identify with, switch it so that you can identify with it. And let me give you an example. there's a category called parenting. I don't have any children. So parenting wouldn't really work for me, but I don't want to miss the opportunity to learn how shame plays itself out in my life. So instead of parenting, what I did was I was a dog owner. And if you want to get into, so the whole thing about parenting is that's an arena where you can feel a lot of shame, right? Is around how you parent and your parenting choices. Well, for those of us who aren't parents, if you're a pet owner, that's an arena where you can feel a lot of shame, where other pet owners judge you for your choices and how you're taking care. So that's the point. So I used being a dog owner for parenting around how I wanted to be perceived by other dog owners and how I did not want to be perceived by other dog owners. So, and then in the category of motherhood, fatherhood, like motherhood, again, don't have kids that didn't, but you know, you could look for me, I looked at sponsoring, how I wanted to be perceived as a sponsor. I took motherhood and thought like, okay, that's basically where I'm playing a maternal role. So what other areas in my life do I play a maternal role, or am I supposed to be cultivating someone? You know, because that's what sponsorship is. We're supposed to take someone and cultivate them to a place where they're better off than they were before. So I use sponsorship. So again, my point is don't skip a category. Do a little thinking and figure out like, okay, what is this arena about? You know what I mean? And then see if you can be like, okay, how does that apply to my life? Also for people who are confused about like being stereotyped or labeled, that can be like, if you're a person of color, or if you're a short person, or if you're an elderly person, something where all of a sudden you're in a group that gets stereotyped. That's the point. And so we can all, you know, it could be like if you're Catholic. I mean, we compartmentalize everyone. So someone has some area, some aspect of themselves that gets stereotyped. And that will then give you, so this is an opportunity, whether you're gay or a person of color, or you're differently abled. I don't know what the proper term is for there. You know, all if you're transgender, anything. So that's what that category is about. So I think that kind of takes care of that. So using the, I'm going to stop sharing. Well, actually, let me do this first. So after we take the categories, we're then going to take each unwanted category, not the ones that we want. The ones that we want are very illuminating for us. And they help us figure out the things that we don't want to be perceived. But then we're going to focus on how we do not want to be perceived, because we are running our whole lives based on controlling how people see us and making sure that we are not perceived in all of these ways. And this is why it's important to do your own inventory, because how I don't want to be perceived is different than how you don't want to be perceived. Like, you may not have any problem with something, and I might be like, oh my God, I don't want people to know that about me. So then we answer these, looking at this list of unwanted identities, for each response, I answer the following questions. What do these perceptions mean to me? Why are they so unwanted? Where did the message that fuel these identities come from? So then I have an example, but rather than going to the example, I'd really like to use the chat function. So we are going to use appearance and body image. So I had my notepad here. Oh, there it is. I found it. All right. So in the chat function, and if you're on the phone, just unmute yourself, but let's get a list of how you want to be perceived. So appearance and body image. How would you like to be perceived? Can someone give me something? Either through chat or if you're on the phone, just. I got 96 people on the phone and no one has given me anything. Someone give me something.
There's a bunch of chats coming through. Can you see those?
No. Here we go. Okay, I got it.
Thanks. Healthy, normal. Yep.
Awesome. Perfect. Okay, so let me go ahead. Let's see. Healthy, normal, another thin, beautiful, attractive, fit. You want to be perceived as trustworthy. Okay, so Kirsten, I would hold off on that. I get what you're talking about, but let's get really superficial with appearance and body image. You know, I think trustworthy would come up in other categories for you. Capable. So I would assume you mean physically capable, slender, tall, healthy, strong. You want to look put together. Great. Nice, fit, strong, beautiful, healthy, thin, fit, acceptable, beautiful, and fit. Self-confident. Yeah. Someone to get to know. Okay. Strong. So you want to have with someone to get to know that there's maybe like a little allure or sparkle about you. Attractive, serene, sexy, confident, fit, capable. You want to be seen as not fat. That's great. Thin, successful, well put together, attractive, sexy, slender, grateful, attractive, physically fit, desirable. I would say, Trisha, I would say grateful for another category. Desirable, definitely, alluring, no excess fat. Flat stomach, chic, strikingly fashionable. Ooh, Sarah, muscular, strong, lean, attractive, accepted, fidelity. James, you'd have to explain that one to me if you want to post that again. No saggy skin. Okay, stylish, good boobs, hot, youthful, pretty, successful, power, masculine, hot. Okay, so that gives us plenty to work from. Own my own body. Okay, everyone, let's stop for outgoing, loved, healthy, and slimmed. Okay, so let's stop there. Now, everyone, what are ways you do not want to be perceived? Unkempt, freak, fat, fat and old, lazy, sloppy, ugly, lobby, hold on. Lazy, ugly, fat, and dumpy. Okay, so lazy, again, we're dealing with appearance, body image. So I wonder, Karen, if you can give me maybe a different word, like would sloppy, is that kind of what you're going for? Ugly, fat, and dumpy, flabby, ugly, unattractive, cowed. Okay, cowed is better than ashamed for me, Jules. That's like, again, appearance. Fat, clumsy, offensive. Someone to laugh at. Okay. Someone to laugh at, like, so physically in a way that everyone would disregard and mock. Freakish, shabby, out of shape, awkward, loser. Oh, again, so one of the words is valence. You know what I mean? Like this presence about us. So some people were talking about, they want a really sparkly presence. And so, maybe with these words that some people are using, you know, awkward, loser, whatever, that you're talking about, that you don't want to have this, like, you know, valence of like, bleh, you know, or whatever. Slothful, that's a good one. Fat and old fashioned, not worthy of attention. So invisible, Bridget, maybe just, you know, smelly, ugly, odd, neutered. Okay, Mary, she would need to know a little bit more what you mean by that. Emaciated, definitely good. Ridiculous, hairy, tatty, unmasculine, unkempt, geeky, angry, deceptive, and slothful, soggy, saggy, wrinkly, ordinary. Oh, good. So again, another word for invisible, you know, that you can be disregarded. Haggard, concentration camp, sickly. Oh, Bernice, that's a good one. Dirty. Okay. So now for your own writing, let's do the assignment, which is, hold on, I have to pull up my own little sheet.
Nicole, I'm just chiming in, it's 2:55.
Okay, so, all right, we're gonna do 2:55, so let me think here for a second. So I wanna go through this one. All right, so we're gonna try and do this last, and then I'm gonna open it up for questions, you guys, so don't worry about it. But let's go ahead and do the first question. So with the unwanted identities, let's pick fat. fats, and so many people picked fat. Why do you not want to be perceived as fat? So let's go. What is that? Why do you not want to be perceived as fat? Society, unattractive. Okay, so fat is considered, it's considered weak. Fat is disgusting. Thank you, Leslie. What is it about fat that you don't want? Lack, okay, people think it means lack of willpower. Hold on, let me. That you're fat means you're unlovable. Fat means you're not coping. It makes, fat makes me feel self-conscious and judge. Because fat people are viewed as lazy and slovenly. They're viewed as greedy. The lie is that if you're fat, you're not in recovery, that you're less than. That's yes. Right. Like perfect people up yes. front, ordinary people at the store, and towards the back of the store. So it looks like you don't care. You're targeted as untrustworthy, like a shoplifter, maybe the cultural prejudice, right? That you're not trying hard enough. That it's an offensive to other people, can't control yourself. Fat equals being lazy, disgusting, unworthy. Fat is perceived as unmasculine and lazy. It's perceived as weak. It's not acceptable by others. It's being different. It's unhealthy. You're going to get a heart attack. Unattractive and not worth love. Fat makes people seem less than, that you're unsuccessful, that you're not smart. That I think she means sad band pitfall. Share if you want to try that again. I don't quite, that you're not in control. That means you don't care about yourself. It means you're not in control of yourself, that there's discrimination. That it's true that fat, it's, you know, you're not allowed to discriminate against other people, but that it's like, it's okay to discriminate against fat people. So it makes you very vulnerable. It does limit your ability to enjoy others in athletics. Well, that's, but we're talking about, Eunice, we're talking about being perceived, why you don't want other people to see you as fat, that you won't get married, that you're undesirable. That's a really good one. I had that one. My mom was like, oh, you're never going to find a man. No self-respect. Being fat is shameful, repellent, degenerate. Wow, listen, you guys, people won't want to associate with me. I'll be abandoned. That you're too big for the world. Lack of discipline, not sexy. Okay, let's cut it off so that I can answer. No more, please, no more chatting, because I want to read what we already have. Clearly evident that I have problems, not successful, joke material, I can't look after myself, how can I look after others, we don't even fit into the world, and lack of, we XL is still too small, so we don't even fit into the world's expectation of how fat you're allowed to be, lack of self-care and worth. Okay, this is really great. Now, the next question is, well, we kind of answered this, like, why are they so unwanted? So I know this is going to seem like, what do these perceptions mean to me? You know what I mean? Like, so we just went through other, so why don't we want this? And I'm going to, and in the interest of time, I'm going to help us get there a little quicker. Well, basically, all of these reasons give people a reason to reject us. So we don't want this because it gives people the reason to kick us out, not let us in, throw us away. You know what I mean? So let me see if I got a couple of new messages. Right. Yes. Love this. Realize I'm not alone. Don't know you all, but already love you. Oh, thank you, Kimmy. Because of our innate desire, right, to be loved and accepted. So that's why we don't want to be perceived this way. We don't want to be perceived in any way that we will then be excluded. We want to belong. We want love and belonging. So let's go to the last question. Okay, hold on. I think I got another chat. Okay. Nope. All right. Let me go to the last question. So where did the messages that fuel this identity come from? So where did the messages that fuel this identity come from? Where did you get these messages? From family, everywhere, media. Hold on, I've lost my place here. Sorry, you guys. Let's see. Other women, school, parents, magazines, mother, parents, society, other women, schoolmates, media and TV, boyfriends, books, movies, work, yes, workplace. My dad used to say to me, nobody loves a fat girl. Family enforced that thin was beautiful in the business you work in. At home with my dad, to my brother, every night at the dinner table, classmates, coworkers, kids on the playground, family of fat women, thin men only liked thin women in the family. Wow. Family, nuns, boyfriends, media, ex-husbands, spouse, friends, physical education teachers. I'm right there with you, Karen. The world, magazines, media, high school, being put on an official diet in the first grade. Wow. Media school, Billy Bunter, good to know. You have, we'll come after Billy for you, Jules. You have such a pretty face, meaning my body wasn't, absolutely. Clothing size, bra sizes, bathing suit sizes that are popular kids in school, fat schoolmate, being ignored by men. Exactly. The fat section of the department store cost more and was dowdy in my time. That's a really good, yeah, I can totally see that. So I'm going to want to switch to Q&A. But let me see, not being on the list of pretty girls in school, that's our doctors, physical therapists, coworkers, exactly. Like, take pause with the chat thing for just a second. I'm not going to take a break. I don't want to lose any of your time. So if you need to take a break, you can go ahead and take care of yourself. But I want to wrap this up by saying, just for those who have done the fourth step, and as we wrote out everything, it revealed more of ourselves to ourselves, right? We learned more about ourselves through doing the fourth step. Well, through, so again, the fourth step is, you know, if you do it in the big book, which is the way that I take my sponsees through and the way that I recommend, you've got the resentment inventory, you've got the fears inventory, the harms inventory, and the sexual conduct. And so each one of those inventories, because I'm forced, and I have to be forced to write out like all of these things, I reveal to myself all the things I'm angry about, all of the fears that I have, all of the sexual harms or sexual shameful things that I've done, all of the ways that I've been an asshole to other people. With the shame inventory, it's the same thing. Like, what is the shape of my shame? Where did these messages come from? You know what I mean? And why am I so geared and wired and driven to make sure that I am not perceived in any of these ways? That has so much control over me. It totally has control over me. So by me turning to the shame inventory, writing it all out, you know, answering the whole, all the little questions for all the categories, I'm like, oh, that's my mom's voice. That's my grandma's voice. Oh, that's the media, which is bullshit. You know, that's whatever. And I get to take some of my power back. And then when I share my shame inventory, same thing with, you know, the fourth step and everything, then I get that emotional regulation that is actually healthy and normal. I take my feelings of shame, I share them with my sponsor, or I share them with my shame study fellows, and I get the emotional regulation, which is empathy is the antidote for shame. If you have shame, shame is about isolating, it's self-rejection out of fear of social rejection. So when I go to connect and share my shame with someone safe, who understands what I'm doing, then I thank you, Jules, share, not shame. So write that down, share, not shame. If you want to get out of shame, you share. So when I am in shame and I connect to someone safe and whatever, all of a sudden they're looking at me with love in their eyes and they're doing what Anne Lamott calls the church of me too. they're looking at me and they're like, me too. I felt that way too. Maybe the details are different, but I felt that way too. And all of a sudden I'm not feeling less than. I'm feeling equal, right? And then I start talking to more and more people and I realize, wait a minute, we all feel this way. This is just being human being. I'm not less than. And now I know that people who think they're better than me are driven by shame. And God bless them. I just want to be here. I just want to be one among many. Okay, so that's 6 minutes over. So I apologize for that. So, it's going to end at 3? I'm sorry, sweetheart. I thought this ended at 3:30.
That's okay. It's good stuff. I think everyone's happy. Let's keep going.
Okay, if people want to go, thank you, JM. Go ahead and go. In my mind, somehow, I thought this was a two-hour workshop, so I thought it went to 3:30. So sorry. For people who want to stay, I'm going to stay on the line to do Q&A and to do share. So that was my mistake. In my mind, I was just tracking a completely different time. I'm not going to feel – oh, thank you. Okay. Good. Someone else thought this was till 3:32. Oh, good. I'm glad I'm not,
It's a safe space. We're all good.
So I want to save this time. So we'll call this post-meeting. The meeting has ended. And for those who want to go at 3, you can. And then for those who want to stay, we can do some Q&A. So we're going to have to use the raise hand function if you have a question. So first we're doing a question. I see you, Mona. Don't worry. First, we're doing questions, and then we'll do open sharing. I will, Deborah. I will send. I see you, Mona and Sharon. Let me post again the link. I'm going to put this in the chat to everyone. So again, you can have it. It's the tinyurl.com/NLS12-step. Okay, so Mona, I'm gonna unmute you and go ahead. Oh, wait. Yeah, Mona.
Hi, Nicole. Hi, everybody. Thank you so much. My name is Mona. I'm a compulsive overeater. Thank you for this workshop. My question is, how do you deal in public when you're being driven to feel shame? For example, for me, like, my mom makes me feel ashamed of my body. How can I, in real time, like, work through that so that I'm not reactive and making myself feel horrible?
Okay, so one of the things that I've learned to say is ouch. So basically, like, put it in real time, or I'll just say, that wasn't very nice. You know what I mean? So basically, this may be difficult, but I promise you, if you practice this, you know, if you practice actually naming it, like, in the moment, like, if your mom, you know, makes a comment about your body, you can say, Mom, that doesn't feel good when you make comments about my body. Honestly, you know, sweetheart, you have to name it in the moment. And even if you can't, like, get the words out, you can just be like, ouch, that didn't feel good. Or you can just come up with something that's just like, you know, Mom, you know, I really don't want any comments about my body. You know, it doesn't feel good. And then you gracefully, and here's the key, you gracefully change the subject, because chances are she's not going to know how to handle that boundary. So you gracefully change the subject and you just move on. You know what I mean? And if she keeps wanting to harp on it, you're like, you know, we don't really need to have a conversation about this. You know, so, but again, in whatever way that you can, in the moment, just come up with something like that's just ouch, or that didn't feel good, or, you know, no comments about my body. You don't have to, you can just be like, you know, no comments about my body. So is that helpful?
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you so much. That's very helpful.
Okay, Sharon.
All right. Real quick, sorry to interrupt. Nicole, do we want to stop recording now that we're kind of into Q&A sharing?
No, Q&A we record, the sharing we don't.
The sharing, got it, yeah. Thank you.
So people, you know, the Q&A is being recorded, and then the sharing we don't, and then this recording will be available for you. Okay, so Sharon.
Hi, can you hear me?
Hello?
Yes, I can hear you. Sorry, honey. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes. Thank you so much, Nicole, for the workshop. I really struggle with picking up the phone. I think I have a lot of shame around picking up the phone, and you said you learned to do it. Do you have any tips on what I can do to pick up the phone, just to pick it up?
Yeah, how I started was I started with like a couple of people in the rooms, you know, and literally how I started was I started with one person, and I started with saying, I'm going to call you when I don't need to call you, just to practice. I mean, because I came in very armored and very isolating, and I didn't trust anyone. And so I picked one person but I was desperate for recovery. And so in forcing myself, you know, I wanted what people had, and I knew I had to do what people were doing. And so that's how I started. I picked the safe person. And then I said, I'm going to practice calling you, and I'm not going to want to stay on the phone. And she was like, cool with it. And so I just picked it up and I called, and I just said, you know, and I made a joke of it. I'm like, oh, this is me practicing, you know? Yeah, I'm doing great. How are you doing? You know what I mean? And that's literally how I started. And then I started to build like two people or three people. And then came the time where, and you might appreciate this, where I actually did need to talk to them, but I still called like I was pretending, and it worked. It still worked. And then it just started to build. It's like, you know, going to the gym. Oh man, it's just, it's so hard. And then you're like, oh, 2 pounds. Oh my God. It's just a, and then like when you're doing 15 pounds, you can't even remember how 2 pounds was hard for you. Is that helpful?
Very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Tina from Chicago. I unmuted you. It's taking a second. There you go.
Hi, Nicole. Thank you for your service. I really appreciate this. Mine's a real simple question.
Sure.
I'd like, again, to kind of understand a little bit more about what the core of shame is.
Less than.
Just.
That's okay. It. That you somehow feel that you're defective. That everyone around you is some sort of whole person and you are broken. That's another way of. That's what shame is.
Okay, thank you.
You're very welcome. Let me lower your hand. Tina, you want to go ahead and lower? Oh, wait, I got it. Okay, Sharon R. Oh, you.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Is that Sharon?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, thank you for doing this, Nicole. This is awesome. Quick question. You had mentioned harm reduction behaviors, and I know you said that's a huge thing. Could you just give me a definition of what that is?
Sure. So, again, because I've been in so many different programs, there are a lot of, like, the addiction programs, drug, alcohol, whatever, where it's much more prevalent, harm reduction. So you work a program in the order that it will kill you. And so, for example, you know, a lot of times drug addicts will suddenly drink a F ton of coffee and smoke a trillion cigarettes a day. Well, that's their harm reduction. So, you know, they're not putting needles in their arms or snorting drugs. They're engaging in a behavior. So while they're working their program and trying to develop, you know, a stronger recovery program, when they feel the urge to use, you know what I mean? They'll do a harm reducing behavior. So they'll reach for a cigarette instead of a line of Coke. So for me, getting off sugar, and I don't want to get into this too much, but for me, getting off sugar was so hard that flour was my harm reduction. And so I let myself reach for flour. Now, again, everyone's like, oh, pray and reach for God. I'm like, well, that wasn't working for me. You know what I mean? And so I really relied on harm reduction behavior. And then when I felt clean off the sugar, then I worked on not doing any flour. And I think I had a harm reduction behavior. Oh, popcorn. I think popcorn was like my harm. And I just kind of got it into where, you know, my harm reduction behavior now is actually not, it's kind of normal. It's like I'll work on I'll do coloring. You know what I mean? When I want to escape, I'll escape in such a healthy way You know, because no one can be 100% emotional all the time. You will notice no one is doing that. So I don't have to do that either. So when I do need, instead of calling it escape, now I call it a timeout. Like, I just need a timeout from adulting. I just need to shut it down. Some people do like a really healthy TV show. That's not really my thing. You know, so for me, I listen to my audiobooks and I'll do my little happy color app. And that's a healthy way of doing a timeout. Does that answer your question? I assume it does.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Leslie Z.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you.
Great. I just want to say thank you so much for your service. I cannot believe, it's so weird when I hear my story come out of somebody else's mouth that I've never even met. It's just like, wow. I just, wow. A question just occurred to me when somebody else was talking about, like, my mother makes me feel ashamed or something like that. I could really use some pointers in the arenas where public shaming is perfectly acceptable. For example, I'm the fat person getting on an airplane and every eyeball says, please let her not be sitting next to me.
I know.
What do I do in that moment?
You know, this might be a little charged, okay? But there's a couple of things. One is you read Shrill by Lindy West. And then the other thing is that in those moments where I am powerless, I really try to practice a sort of Tonglen is what it's called. And here's the idea. So there you are, you're the fat person getting on the plane, and everyone is looking at you. What you are experiencing in that moment is how the world takes a group of people and prejudices them against them. And what I can tell you is that the mother with the baby who's getting on the plane is experiencing the exact same thing. And the, you know, 6'4" black guy getting on the plane is experiencing the exact same thing. And so if in any way you can take this feeling, this is my personal, so this is way my personal practice here, where when I am feeling something that uncomfortable, now I can go into a shame spiral, but I have no control over this at all. And I don't want to go into a shame spiral. So whenever I'm feeling really bad or full of fear or full of shame or whatever, what I try to do is energetically almost connect with all the people who have ever felt the way that I am feeling right now. And when I do that, it actually does do this sort of church of me too. So in that moment, when you're getting on the plane, if you could think of like you, whoever has a baby, you know, whoever looks like they might be Arabian. I mean, you know, that you are now part of like this group of people that when you get on a plane, no one wants you sitting next to. Do you know what I mean? And that you're not alone.
God, I'm going to cry. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
That was beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for your bravery for asking that question. Okay, Narelle. Am I saying it right?
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much for this workshop. I loved what you said about saying that wasn't very nice or ouch. And I guess my question is, I did that recently, which was like so hard to do. But I think what happened was it triggered the other person's shame, like it was a put down. It said in a joking way, but I'd had enough. And I said, oh, that wasn't very nice. And then that person became really hurt. Because I think I kind of triggered her shame. And then somehow my shame became worse because I had triggered her and I thought it was all my fault. And I was like, maybe I shouldn't have said that. So then I was caught up in this sort of shame dance. Is there any suggestions for how I can just halt that and just hold on to my own stuff? Because that's really enough to deal with.
Yeah. And also, I just want you to know that experience that you had is very normal. And I've had that too. And to be totally blunt, that's where we then have to work our codependent recovery. Whether you want to work that officially or not, I really recommend. And so that is where it's like you set a boundary, she hit that boundary, and you called her out on her behavior. And then she reacted to that. Like she was like, yeah, that was actually not nice. You know what I mean? And so then she goes into a shame spiral and you're taking responsibility for her feelings. She's the one who put herself in that situation. Do you see what I mean?
She's the
one who behaved that way and you called her out on it. And now she's experiencing. So you're not the one who caused her to have a shame spiral. You're the one that said, no, I'm not actually going to let you discharge your shame onto me, which is what all of that criticizing is that, you know, we put people down or criticize them. That's our shame that we're discharging on other people, you know, as a way to make to puff ourselves up a little bit. And so that's how people discharge shame. And so if she was discharging her shame onto you, you deflected that and it went back on her. And then she was confronted with her own behavior. And then here's the super hard part. And I need to tell you that Al-Anon and CODA, I have made more program calls in those programs, because when I set a boundary later in the moment, I felt so guilty and so bad for it. So you really just have to know that that's what you're going to feel. And you just and do everything that you can. And it's hard. It is so hard. But if you keep doing it, it will get easier. You literally, like what I do is I feel the bottom of my feet and I keep breathing because I'm having all of these feelings and I want to take it all back and make her feel better and you know, and do whatever. And I'm like, I've got to hold my ground. I've got to hold my ground, which means I'm going to be flushed with these very uncomfortable feelings. And I just hold my ground. And you know, it's going to be very painful in the beginning, but over time you will learn. And then when she's had her, you might even have to say, you know, I think it's time, you know, that we just take a break. If she's not going to come out of it, because basically she might then go into some sort of unconscious emotional manipulation where she wants you to make her feel better for slapping you, which by the way, if you ever want to see this played out, like all you got to do is read Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. It's called gaslighting. You know what I mean? And it kind of happens in traditional, you know, for those who are older, you know, men and women, men do this all the time. Women call men out on their behavior. This is gross. I know that women do this to men, but I'm talking from my experience, whatever, these general ways that it's like you get one person who, you know, gets called out on their behavior. They feel bad. And then somehow the conversation turns into the person who was slapped, making the perpetrator feel better. Do you get what I'm saying?
Mm. Thank you so much. I'm going to keep practicing that.
Yeah. Just practicing that and know that you're going to feel uncomfortable.
All right. And that's not a bad sign.
Right. No, my sponsor finally told me when I was going through the shame thing, she said, Nicole, you are going to have to learn how to feel uncomfortable.
Okay.
Like that is growing up, you know, is that I have to learn how to feel uncomfortable.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. So someone asks, where can this recording be found after? I'm going to edit it and then I'll send it to Melinda and it will be on my drive, but then I will send Melinda a link because their website isn't designed to host. But the link for the recordings will be on the foothill.org site. Okay, Sarah, you've been waiting. Everyone's waiting very patiently. And again, if you're over this conference, just go, you know, the rest of us are like, okay, Sarah, go ahead.
Thank you very much. So the thing that's really interesting to me is I have been recovering.
I lost you there.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Thanks. So I have been recovered now for almost 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems like the hits just keep on coming.
Yep.
Life on life's terms. You know, this shame for me, I won't go into my history, but I share something similar to what you shared about your past.
Right.
And, you know, the one thing that's been really interesting for me lately is that I've started realizing that I have been really pretty superficial you know, like I'll listen to something like this and then go off and do something else instead of reflecting on. And so all of a sudden I'm like, no, 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 no. I need to sit with this. I need to dig. I need to go deeper. Mm-hmm. And that's been really powerful for me to realize that I've been skimming over the top because I don't want to go. It's like the other night, I have this wonderful little book on dreams, and it said, you know, pray before you go to sleep that you can partake of the banquet of your dreams and remember them.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden this voice in me was like, fuck no, I don't want to remember them. So anyway, I just want to thank you. And also to ask you, are you doing any workshops? I mean, is this something that's available to participate in with you? You mentioned that, and I don't know what that means.
No, I get asked, just like Melinda, she heard me somewhere from Central Oregon. I mean, people hear me and then they say, would you come to our inner group? And mm-hmm. I don't lead them personally. You know, okay. I have a podcast, and it's weird to say like, oh, I have a podcast of recovery. So let me just give a little explanation on that, which is that I've got some virtual sponsees in Canada, and I got really tired of saying the same things over and over again. So I started recording myself, you know, the homework assignments and explaining them and explaining all the analogies. And I had all these recordings and they were taking up too much space on my G drive. And so I was like, oh, how can I host free recordings? You know what I mean? And then, you know, this, you know, podcast thing came up. And so I have a recovery podcast, which has like, and then now I've kind of fallen in love with it because now I've, you know, interview my friends and we talk about like depression in recovery and anxiety in recovery and stuff like that. So, so that's the best that I have is kind of like, you know, the recordings that are on the G drive that I have. And then, my recovery, my podcast, okay. Which I'll post again. And the link that I send is the very first one that I did where I tell my story. And that was at an Al-Anon conference.
Okay.
So, but thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, Bridget, waiting so patiently.
Thank you so much, Nicole. I'm new to OA. And so I'm just so grateful and blessed to be able to find these kind of Zoom meetings for inspiration. My question is, do you have any advice when my behavior, my body is creating shame for my young son? And I asked because earlier this year there was an incident at school. There was a classmate that he's really trying to win over. Mm-hmm. So he took one of his favorite books to school to share with him. And the kid's response was, I don't want to look at your book. I don't want to be your friend. Your mom is fat and lazy and disgusting. And this is like, this is dialogue. Obviously it's coming from his home,
yeah.
But these are two first graders.
Yeah.
And so that's creating a lot of shame for my son. And he's been talking to me about like, I love you, but I want you to be skinny like the other moms. And so what advice do you have to help him cope with that? And how do I not allow my choices to become his shame?
Well, I have to say that's above my pay grade, but here's what, here's what my instinct is, which is number one. So I sponsor, I call them the mom squad. I have some moms that I sponsor and I reinforce to them, if you do your own work, you will stop the progression of this disease because it's intergenerational. You didn't develop an eating disorder because you had nothing better to do. You know, ism is a family disease. It's a family system disease. And so whether there was alcoholism in your family or not, you might notice that there was extreme religion or there was gambling or there was something. But, you know, it's like that's why ACOA changed its name to Adult Children of Alcoholics / Dysfunctional Families, because so many people who couldn't point to alcoholism were identifying with the effects. So if you want to arrest the intergenerational shame, focus on yourself. And then my second thing is that, you know, the other thing that popped into my head was my friend, one of my sponsees took her son and her daughter and then their neighbors who are their best friends who are from East African. They're just newly like a couple years here, and they were playing. And so it's, you know, two white kids and two black kids. And one of the kids from a whole nother family came over and told Emmett not to play with the black kids, you know, which it just blows my mind. But why I'm telling you that is that, you know, Emmett had to go back, and it's like, people are going to do horrible things and we can't stop them from doing that. So I think that telling your son, you know what I mean, like, oh, he wants you to be thin like all the other moms, it's just say, I don't think that you should agree to that. I personally don't think that you should ascribe and teach him and pass on this training that being thin is being better. I first of all, it's not a healthy dynamic. But again, this is so above my pay grade, but just instinctually, I would tell the way that you know, with the you know, people of color would have to tell their children of color, some people are not going to want to play with you because you're different. You know what I mean? That's what you got to teach your son, is that people are mean, and sometimes they don't like other people because they look different. You know what I mean? It's lookism, which I'm going to do a podcast on, by the way, you know? And so that's more of my recommendation. Does that help at all?
It does help. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay. Mary Shee, hang on there, Jules. We're almost there. All right. Mary Shee or Shea?
Shay, sorry. Where is it? Oh, here. Trying to put my video thing on. Thank you so much, Nicole. I've really appreciated so much what you had to say today. You know what, I was just curious, and this is a question about your personal experience, because it sounds like you've done a lot of work around this over the years, and I'm just starting to, after many years in recovery, to start to dig into the real core shames. And I was just wondering how you experienced the lessening of that shame in your body.
How I experienced it?
Yeah, because I know how I experience it in my body now. And I was just curious how you started to notice in your body when it started to lessen.
How I noticed it was in the mirror. I mm-hmm. started to notice my thoughts when I saw myself in the mirror. Hmm. You know, and so I started to notice that there's a thing in psychology that, thank you, Diane. There's a thing in psychology that I learned as an 18-year-old, which was they did these tests where they brought in these people, they saw a beautiful painting, and then at the very bottom of the painting was like a splotch. And so what they did was the people came in and they saw the beautiful painting, and then what the psychologist did was they timed how long it took them to see the splotch. So they blew, they'd be looking, and then they'd note it. But first they were struck by the painting. Then they brought them in again, and they brought them in again. And the second time, you know, that they came in to see the painting, their eyes started to go straight for the splotch. So again, that perception of seeing what is wrong. So my eyes, this is body image dysmorphia. And this is a whole nother topic that I do a workshop on. So I don't want to get too much in, but that when my eyes looked in the mirror, all it saw was all of my flaws, you know, and that's all that I could see. And that's body image dysmorphia. I could not see that I was an attractive woman. All I could see were all of the things that my eyes were too close together. You know, my face was too big, my boobs were, you know, that's all I could see. And so what I noticed in the healing of my shame was that I would see myself in the mirror and I just saw a person. I just saw a woman. I just saw myself. And then I actually started to, you know, over time, like look in the picture and be, hey, cutie, you're looking cute today. I mean, I couldn't even imagine doing that. You know, I couldn't even imagine, like, so that was personally how I experienced that, just by looking in the mirror, was that having this internal experience of loving the image that I was seeing reflected back at me.
Thank you.
Okay, Jules, so patient.
Yeah, I don't feel patient at all. I feel like it's easy to be patient. Well, easy to be listening to all of you. So brilliant. I am doing step eight by going back to step four and forgiving, and who haven't I forgiven, and myself. And I realized I've got excess guilt, and it all ties in with this shame workshop you're doing, and it's all cropped up with a sponsee doing step five and all the sex and all of this and that and the other. One of my greatest shames has been my sponsee killed herself quite horribly, and I was ashamed. Yeah, and I was also ashamed that people in the fellowship with me didn't speak to me. And then I was angry with them. And I get your sharing this workshop. I really get it. Name it, don't blame it. God will reframe it. I get what you've been saying. I am wondering whether, with a grief like suicide, whether it would be good to do what I didn't do then, which was go to grief counselling, because a suicide, like if an ordinary death, you always regret things. There's always something you regret. But a suicide is beyond the experience of most of what I hear people in the fellowship saying. And when it's a sponsee, the response for 12 years, it's just this god-awful betrayal by God, just like you shared, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm not saying it to complain about it. I am really enjoying my journey at the moment. And thank you all. Bless you all. Thank you. I'll hand back to you, Nicole.
Well, again, this is non-conference approved, but my parents were alcoholics. My best friend's family took me in, and they became my family of choice. And 2 years ago, my foster mom and dad both got stage four cancer. They were diagnosed in the same week, and 6 months later, they were both dead. And so grief is a very up topic for me. And I have to tell you, and again, sorry, everyone on the phone or on the call, that Griefcast really, really helped me, the podcast. And there's an episode in Griefcast, and I would search for it. So it's Carrie Ed Lloyd, Griefcast. And there is an episode in there where the dad commits suicide, and she talks about that. So I would definitely start there, because again, the reason why I'm directing that to you, Jules, is you know, the one identifying with the other, the church of Me Too, listening to someone else, not a professional, but someone who has experienced what you experience. And again, because I listened to that podcast, I know what you're talking about around, you know, the complexity of suicide, you know, feeling like they left you, they abandoned you. And also, I can only imagine, you know, I can't know what it feels like to have your fellowship blame you for her suicide. Again, the remedy is the same that I said for, you know, the large woman on the plane and whatever, is just like, oh, this is what it feels like for a mother whose child commits suicide, everyone looking at her. So, and again, that whole Tonglen thing, it's not Tonglen, I'm misdoing it. It's a piece of Tonglen, but I'm not going into the whole thing. It's just like, I am not alone in this experience. This experience is not only happening to me. This experience happens to people all the time, and that there are resources for me. And of course, if you need someone to talk to, you're more than welcome to call me. Of course, I have WhatsApp, but again, I do really, this is another one that's above my pay grade. I can identify with, in a different experience, which is a different story, of having lost my sobriety and having people in the room treat me differently. And just, it was very jarring. It's like, we don't shoot our wounded, and yet you're all shooting me. So, you know, again, we're a bunch of sick people trying to get well. So even in the rooms, you're not going to get the best, you know, and hopefully maybe some of those people will do some work. And then in 5 or 6 years, you'll get an amends letter from them. I mean, who knows? Either way, what I can tell you is you've done nothing wrong. You know, and if you need me to say that publicly and out loud, I can say you've done nothing wrong. And there's absolutely nothing you could have done to prevent someone's suicide, the same way that no one can prevent someone's alcoholism. So, you know, in that case, I hope to take that off your shoulders. But it definitely, I would go to Griefcast. I still, 2 years on, I still listen to Griefcast just as a way of like, because grief can be such an isolating experience because you have this great death in your life that is impacting every aspect of your life or a large part of it. And you have to go out and act as if everything's fine because you have to just keep going. So, okay, so we're out of questions, which is great. People, you've been such amazing troopers. I can't believe we still have 58 people on the line. That's amazing. Melinda, you've been so gracious with your time. I'm going to stop recording, and I'm certainly willing to